Today, the guardians of your super say, nothing to see here. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to this post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Today, I'm joined by Robbie Barwick from the Citizens Party. Hi, Robbie.
Hi, Martin.
How are you going?
Yeah, good. Probably better than the banks.
Yeah.
Better than the banks and better than the, we always say better than the economy. I think I'm going better than them. And we've got something interesting to talk about, which is a bit of a theme you and I've covered quite a bit in the past.
Yeah, well, it's quite interesting because there was a letter released by the RBA. It relates to the use of derivatives in the superannuation sector. And this is just a whole weird thing.
It is. And I'd like to read some excerpts of, there's two letters. There's a letter from the Treasurer to the RBA and a reply from the RBA. And I think it's worth reading out some of the excerpts of these. Mm-hmm. But let me first state to me the strangest initial thing. The Treasurer who wrote the letter last November was Josh Frydenberg. And essentially what Josh Frydenberg does in this letter is he expresses concern about the scale of the derivatives used by some super funds.
Yes.
Now, if you know Josh Frydenberg's background, Martin, he is from the biggest derivatives basket case bank in the world, Deutsche Bank. His ex-bank, that where he did his time as an investment banker, which is what qualified him to be treasurer, seemingly, is a basket case when it comes to derivatives. It's been on life support by the Europeans and the German government for a long time. There's been lots of worry that it would become the next Lehman Brothers for a long time. And I can just imagine what's been scrambling behind the scenes there with derivatives. Now, so that's one curiosity. If Josh Frydenberg is expressing concern about derivatives, then it must be potentially very bad. You could say that. There is a school of thought, which I haven't totally dismissed, that because he's a liberal, he may have an ulterior motive here, which is the liberals really have an issue with industry super funds. They hate them on behalf of the banks because the banks hate them, right? So now this is a complicated picture. And in general, in terms of performance, the industry super funds have shown the banks up. And this was quite evident in the Royal Commission as well. There's a lot of sniping by liberals against industry super, and maybe that's an ulterior motive here. He's trying to make a mountain out of a molehill. The thing is, though, he doesn't single out industry super in the letter, right? Now, can I read some of the things that he said in this letter before we get the answer? So bear in mind, this is a person from Deutsche Bank, you know, a bank that has lots and lots of bad derivatives. So he wrote this in November last year. He talked about there was several rounds of consultation as part of finalizing the portfolio holdings disclosure regime that will apply to super funds. Here's the quote. This process identified that some superannuation funds appear to be engaging in a large number of derivatives transactions. Then he elaborated. He said that can be appropriate as risk management, but, quote, such transactions also have the potential to expose superannuation funds to large liabilities if not prudently managed. And therefore, he emphasizes that because super is now up to $3.3 trillion, it's a systemically important part of the financial system. He says it is therefore important that the extent and nature of the use of derivatives is examined, including the implications for the operation of our financial system during times of stress. And he's asked the Reserve Bank, on behalf of the Council of Financial Regulators, to reply about this. He says, I seek this advice by the 30th of June, 2022. And in particular, he's asked them to assess this in terms of any broader implications in terms of financial system stability. Now, frankly, I think, putting aside his motives, I think those are the right questions to ask.
It's a good question. A good set of questions, isn't it? Yeah.
They are a good set of questions. But note that this is, until the Reserve Bank released this correspondence, this is just among the top echelons, yep, of the financial system.
Yep.
They're not telling the broader public out there, who we all have our money in super, right? And I can only imagine what the particular funds were. We know what the big funds are. He's not telling the broader public out there, you know, be concerned here, but maybe he should have been, right? So anyway, yeah, that's the letter that comes from Frydenberg. Now, I have to make one other point. There's another Deutsche Bank angle here, because he was writing to Philip Lowe as the chairman of the Council of Financial Regulators. And the Council of Financial Regulators, Martin, represents the RBA, Treasury, APRA, the bank regulator, and ASIC. And so here you've got an ex-Deutsche Bank treasurer writing to the Council of Financial Regulators that includes an ex-Deutsche Bank lawyer, because Joe Longo is a former longtime lawyer for Deutsche Bank, actually on the front line over there in Europe. That's where he was a lawyer. So I'm thinking that these people should know a thing or two about derivatives, right, in having this correspondence. So that's the letter. Let's go through the reply.
Well, just before we go to the reply, it's worth saying that was last November, right? So that was at the point when Phil Lowe was saying interest rates are going to stay, right, at 0.1% until 2024, right? Nothing to see here. Everything's absolutely fine. Just remember that.
Exactly. That is an incredibly I made some notes here for this discussion, Martin. That's in my notes. You and I haven't compared notes on this.
Yeah.
That is, I saw like you, that's an incredibly relevant context to this correspondence.
Yep.
So here's the reply, 29th of June, 2022. And by the way, a day before the deadline. I mean, these people, sorry, they're arseholes.
And Robbie, I would just say, it's interesting, this was a PDF reply, right? So it's actually very hard to actually be able to take the text and immediately do something with it without actually manipulating. Normally they put it up in text format. No, this was a PDF copy.
Well, who doesn't trust whom in this dog-eat-dog world of high finance, eh? All right. So the reply in one line is, there's nothing to see here. That's you read it, I read it. That's the line. There's nothing to see here.
Yep.
Now, we're reading between the lines. We should get well paid for being able to price something down so well, Martin, but let's hear the elaborated version. Okay. The CFR, and this is key, because I said he wrote to the Council of Financial Regulators. In his version of the letter, you actually don't see that he's written to the Council of Financial Regulators, his version of the letter, right? However, the reply by Dr. Philip Lowe is on behalf of the Council of Financial Regulators. So maybe that was the intention all along. It's just that it's interesting that it didn't show up in the first letter. So here's the answer. The Council of Financial Regulators' assessment is that derivatives usage by superannuation funds is predominantly for risk management purposes. It raises no particular concerns at this point of time. So that's the nothing to see here. Going on, they do acknowledge that derivatives exposures of trustees, i.e. super funds, are, quote, currently concentrated amongst a handful of funds. I don't know if we can find somewhere the list of these funds that have expressed concern, because they're not in the original letter and they're not in the reply. But nevertheless, we know there's a handful of funds with a large derivatives exposure. Then jumping down, he goes, our assessment is that the legislative and regulatory framework governing trustees' use of derivatives is, quote, sound and comprehensive. That sounds good. And then he says this, one important element of this framework is that trustees are not permitted to use derivatives for gearing purposes, brackets, SIS Act, which is the superannuation industry, whatever, the main act covering the establishment of the superannuation industry. So that act bars super funds from using derivatives for gearing purposes, you know, to leverage up their investments. The main effect, it goes on to say, the main effect of this constraint is that use of derivatives is limited to risk management, and derivatives may not be used to gain leveraged exposure to market risks. And that actually sounds fine as far as it goes. And then the final sentence I want to just highlight here is, as a consequence of the limitation on gearing, derivatives exposures are unlikely to become a large share of any trustee's total assets. So that's the nothing to see here. This is okay. But super fund derivatives, as at 30 June 2021, and look at the types of exposure, 77% of foreign exchange, 8.9% are interest rates. And question mark, rising rates? Because, yes, as you know, all derivatives are based on assumptions. I don't care if they're hedging, they're still bets. And there would have been derivatives contracts written after Philip Lowe, 2 months in a row, at the end of last year, made his assurance that there would be no interest rate rises in Australia until 2024. That was effectively the promise he made, as far as it goes. There's a lot of pissed off people expressing their disgust at him now. Lots of calls for him to be sacked from the Reserve Bank, etc. Because that assurance, you know, and sorry, I'm going to use words like that, because when it comes from the governor of the Reserve Bank, you know, as you and John Adams did a show, you know, he's the god of Australia's financial system. And don't kid yourself, these governors, like what's his Greenspan mastered in America in his day, they cultivate this. They are the high priests of the financial system. They like to have their word as law and not be questioned, right? Philip Lowe doesn't get dragged before Senate estimates in Australia. His deputy does, right? He's above that. So he said that about interest rates, and a lot of people, including financial system experts who trade in derivatives, possibly for super funds, they're not geniuses. They just like saying, oh, okay, there's the Reserve Bank said this, so we don't need to hedge against interest rate rises. We'll hedge against other things, right? I'm just talking hypothetically, but this can have consequences. So 6 months later, he's saying nothing to see here, everything's okay. But what's actually percolating underneath there? Because of what's happened in the last 6 months, because not only did interest rates go up, they've gone right up, right? All the fundamental settings of the financial system has changed. So to say nothing to see here, when we can identify quite easily that part of the financial system has changed so dramatically, and that's what affects derivatives when their assumptions are wrong, maybe there's a bigger story.
Mm. So there's a couple of observations, Robert. The first is, of course, currencies have also moved, and some of the derivatives are also currency related, right? And the idea of derivatives in the context of super would be to, you know, hedge against adverse movements of rates. So in theory, it might not be an issue, except, of course, there'd be somebody on the other counterparty that now would be, very concerned about the way that rates had gone. Second point is, of course, there's no disclosure out there as to which super funds are actually using derivatives and which aren't. It's not actually I had a quick look in a couple of the recent disclosure processes, and I can't see anything specific. So it's very hard to know which superannuation funds we're talking about. I assume they're the bigger ones, but, you know, I've no idea. But then the third point is, well, there's another big chunk of the financial system, right, that is using derivatives not just for protection purposes, but for speculative purposes, right? And they are the major banks. So how can the superannuation sector essentially, you know, be looked at and confirmed, yeah, you can use derivatives, but only as a risk mitigation strategy, right? When the rest of the financial system is using it to try and, game the system and to make loads of money. This doesn't this doesn't feel right to me at all.
No, if super funds need those restrictions, because it would be imprudent to use derivatives in other ways, like gearing, you know, gearing up their investments for leverage on their investments. Presumably then the masters of the financial system are wise enough to say that super funds shouldn't be exposed to that. Well, they own 20% of the banks that do nothing but. That's exposure, isn't it? The banks, and we have a mutual friend that was part of a discussion that we've had in the last few days on this, who's a former APRA principal researcher, Dr. Wilson Tsai, and he made a point that is quite relevant to this discussion, which is that there's much more transparency. Now, you and I don't know, as you've said, which super funds they're talking about. But in general, the Treasurer was able to see these figures for the super funds. There's more transparency in the super funds than there are in the banks. Does the Treasurer know what's in the banks in terms of derivatives? Because we certainly don't know. And also, I pose the question, do any of the restrictions on the use of derivatives that apply to super trustees, again, because presumably there's an acknowledgement they're dangerous, do any of those apply to the banks, of which four account for 80% of our financial system and are the definition of systemically important? And in fact, collectively, they're globally systemically important. Do any of those restrictions apply to them? And the answer is absolutely not. And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, Martin, because it's been a few months since you and I last talked about this in broad terms, but you, over the last few years, have seen the derivatives trading of the banks increase as a percentage of their activity and their profits, right?
Well, yeah. So it's been a very significant element at the same time as the disclosure from them is actually being reduced, right? So the thing about derivatives is you can measure the exposure of derivatives as a gross exposure, as a net exposure, or as a likely loss, right? And actually, if you go back a few years around the world, banks were reporting this global exposure, right?
Yeah.
But the BIS basically cramped down on that, and locally now it's very hard to understand how much total exposure there is. What we do know is that in the last couple of years, a lot of the big organizations here in Australia and around the world have made a lot more from trading, right?
Which is not hedging.
Trading means it's actually to do with taking positions and taking a gamble on where the markets are going to go, and then effectively using derivative products, options and futures and all the swaps, all those things, both currency and interest rate, to try and actually take a position and make money, right? And the trading floors of many banks around the world are littered with derivatives contracts, right? Mm. Now, the point is that these derivatives are always difficult to risk assess in a stable market.
Yeah.
But when markets are going the way they're going, which is huge swings in terms of interest rates and exchange rates, the potential losses, because for every transaction and every contract, there's a counterparty with the other side of the risk. So if somebody's actually protected their position, somebody else is taking a bath.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
That translates ultimately to instability and risk within the financial system that is not being fully disclosed, firstly, that is not being fully managed, in my view, and is actually being encouraged by the regulators. That does not make sense, and particularly because those same banks, of course, are the very banks that have our deposits, right?
Remember after the global financial crisis, the globally coordinated response to that through the G20 was not to say we must stop the banks engaging in this reckless activity that has literally blown up the financial system. It was to say we need more buffers for when they have their next accident. That was essentially it. And those buffers were households. That's what bail-in is. You and I have been part of a campaign for quite a long time now to restore the Glass-Steagall separation of banks so that banks with deposits were not allowed to have anything to do with this kind of activity. That was in place in America from 33 to 99. And in that nearly seven decades, there were no systemically There was no systemic financial crisis in the United States. And of course, as the biggest financial system in the world, it was stability for the whole world. They scrapped that in 1999, and within a decade, less than a decade, 9 years later, you know, after this massive spike in global over-the-counter derivatives trading, the whole system blew up. And the answer was obvious. You had people like Lord Nigel Lawson, who's the Chancellor of the who was the Chancellor of the Exchequer under Thatcher, who initiated what was called the Big Bang financial deregulation of the British financial system in the mid-80s, acknowledged that that kind of action, which had scrapped the division between commercial banking and investment banking in the UK, was at fault. And he, after the global financial crisis, campaigned to restore Glass-Steagall. You had Sandy Weill in America, the former president of Citibank, who was credited with breaking the Glass-Steagall law. He has a plaque on his desk called the Shatterer of Glass-Steagall. In 2012, he came out and said, we were wrong, right? We need to bring Glass-Steagall back. So these were the people who had the best perspective. They knew why they wanted to get rid of Glass-Steagall. They were honest enough to acknowledge that they caused this massive problem and they need to bring it back. And they were ignored. And instead, the G20 and the Bank for International Settlements and the Financial Stability Board went ahead with bail-in instead. So don't tell the banks to change their activity. Let's just turn human beings, their customers, households, right? That you and I did a show with this Bank of England executive Paul Tucker, saying the only thing you have as a buffer is households. There's nothing else, right? Households would be the buffer next time the financial system crashed. That's what they set up. Now, I mean, what is super? It is the collective savings of households in Australia. Talk about a buffer. I mean, I hope my alarm for super isn't well founded, but certainly hopefully it is safer than the banks. But from the bank standpoint, this is quite alarming. I also want to remind people, Martin, that we've done some. Our party was tracking this question of derivatives from the early 90s, because we've long advocated reforms of the financial system to make sure it goes back to serving the real economy. And we saw the rise of derivatives, and we tracked that. And I in 1994, I sat down and went through all the banks' annual reports and made my first graph of Australian bank derivatives. And it showed you, you know, back then you could see there's the bank's assets at tens of billions of dollars, but here's this much higher bar of bank derivatives at hundreds of billions of dollars, right? And so this was shocking even then. And every year, the annual reports of the banks would report their gross exposure to derivatives. So we would produce these updated reports regularly to show people, look, this is the latest on Australian bank derivatives. In 2012, after the global financial crisis, the Commonwealth Bank, starting with the Commonwealth Bank, it stopped disclosing this in its annual report. Nothing to see here. I called them up. I got put through to some board room or whatever on a top floor. I said, why have you stopped disclosing derivatives in your annual report? And they said, oh, it's not a relevant figure. I said, what do you mean it's not a relevant figure? It's 2012. A few years ago, there was a global financial crisis caused by these things. You're telling me it's not relevant? And they go, oh, no. You're talking about those risky credit derivatives. No. Doesn't matter. Our derivatives are just plain vanilla derivatives, right? That's what they told me. They started it. I think NAB was next, then ANZ. And now none of them disclose the gross exposure of their derivatives. But you know what we detected before they stopped disclosing it, though, was this enormous increase. Yep. So whereas the rest of the world somewhat plateaued the expansion of the global derivatives bubble, the BIS figures didn't show massive growth. In Australia, there was massive growth. And we've got a graph here. Even though the banks stopped disclosing it individually through their annual report, the Reserve Bank has kept figures. Now, these figures are not necessarily the full picture, but at least the reserve, even these figures from the Reserve Bank, if you look at this graph, what you see there is the enormous post global financial crisis growth of Australian bank derivatives. They went from about, I think it was less than 14 trillion in 2008 to soared right up to close, I think a little bit, I think they went a little bit over 50 trillion and have come down a little bit into the mid 40 trillions of dollars. That's enormous growth in the last decade of the post GFC financial system. And that's what the banks are not individually exposing anymore. What lies in there is the question Australians should be concerned about.
Well, and it's even more of a question also, because those are actually the contracts, right? But the risks within those contracts are not reported anywhere. None of the auditors actually go through them. None of the public reporting actually highlights the risks that are actually contained in there, because the risks are unknowable at any point in time, because they're completely determined by where markets go.
Yeah.
Right? So in other words, the risks last November or December, when we were at 0.1% in terms of interest rates, are completely different to 1.35% or more, right? Or the global interest rates as they move. Or the exchange rate. Our exchange rate now is, what, 67 cents to the US, right? Those are huge moves, which means that essentially for every contract, there is a significant exposure and movement. Now, we don't know, they don't know, I don't think they know just how much exposure there is there, right? And the question is that an acceptable position for an organization to be in, an organization that is a pillar of our financial system and an absolute cornerstone of the Australian economy, right? In other words, there's a risk set of issues here that nobody is fully across. And I'm very concerned about that. I've been concerned about it for years. And because of the most recent market movements, I think this question needs to be a much broader one than just chucked at superannuation funds. So what about what about Chalmers writing to the RBA and saying, what about derivative exposures in the banks, right?
Well, maybe we should encourage Australians to write to Jim Chalmers and tell him to ask that question. What is the derivatives exposure of the banks? Because if Josh Frydenberg can get alarmed at the derivatives exposure of a handful of super funds, then you better look at what's in the banks, because that is the real story. This year, just look at, so the derivatives tend to, you know, even if they're hedging, it's the movements in markets, as you said. Exchange rates, interest rates, also indices, right? Stock markets, commodity markets, etc. All those have gone haywire this year. All of them, right? You've had who would have predicted? And that's the problem. This is not to we shouldn't necessarily judge Philip Lowe for getting it wrong, but he should own up to getting it wrong. I don't think he's really done that yet. Who would have predicted these events? But that's the nature of the financial system that they've created. So you've now got a bizarre situation where interest rates have skyrocketed, commodity markets have gone haywire, the price of the fundamental commodities like oil, you know, gone through the roof and then up and down and whatever. The strongest performing, after collapsing after the invasion of Ukraine, now the ruble is the strongest performing currency. The Russian ruble is the strongest performing currency this year. All those sanctions completely backfired on the United States and the West for doing that. This is the nature of it. This is all unpredictable. But there's tens of trillions of dollars of derivatives bets in the banks that are affected by all this.
So
write to the Treasurer Jim Chalmers and say you better ask this question, because that's where. Come back to bail in. That's why we warned about it. And remember, I'll go back to the. I was struck by this formulation from Josh Frydenberg, including the implications of the operation for our financial system during times of stress. And our whole argument, Martin, about the danger that deposits in Australia may be bailed in under the law that they snuck through in 2018, is precisely that. Yeah, the politicians who passed this law may think it's unthinkable that deposits could be bailed in under it. But in times of stress, if that law has a big enough loophole that it doesn't explicitly stop the APRA from bailing in deposits to save the banks, then there's a danger APRA will bail in deposits to save the banks, because that's what happens in times of stress. That was the story of the global financial crisis, and that would be the story again. And the risks are massive now in the financial system. And so let me get a plug in. We need, we need more transparency, and people should demand more transparency. But it's why my party is fighting hard for solutions. We've got a bill introduced twice for Glass-Steagall in Australia to cut Australians off the deposit taking banks in Australia off from any of this derivatives transactions. That'll involve a huge unwinding, but it's necessary. We need an alternative banking sort of harbour for safe deposits, and that's why we propose a postal bank, right, a public bank, that if they're not going to bring in Glass-Steagall, and even if they do bring in Glass-Steagall, if there's a government-owned bank there where the deposits are guaranteed because it's government-owned, people are going to put their money in it, and they need somewhere safe to put their money, especially in times like this. And a public bank will not have any reason to use derivatives. And then tell people, then, what we also need is a development bank / infrastructure bank perspective in Australia, where people can take their money out of super or insist to their super funds, you put my savings into the infrastructure, you invest in the infrastructure bank, please. Buy government bonds that capitalize the infrastructure bank, because I want my money to go in there. No derivatives required. Let's actually go back to making our income and our wealth from the economic development of Australia. That's our perspective as a political party.
No, absolutely. It makes a lot of sense. And I just want to underscore one other thing, right? Because there is some potential good use of derivatives for risk mitigation if you are effectively offsetting unexpected movements in exchange rates, right, or interest rates, right, or commodity prices. That's where derivatives started. If you go back to corn, in the 18, whatever it was, and into the 1900s and whatever, right? But what's happened is that we've now got traders taking positions, derivative on derivative, backed by another derivative. So effectively, if you look at the underlying transaction pool, the multiplication of the derivative structures that we've got means that effectively it's not simply about risk mitigation. This is about making money out of making money.
Yeah.
Right. And that's the thing that you and I both share a big concern about, because if effectively the financial system and banks are there with the ability to make money out of making money out of making money by taking huge bets, right, that is a highly risky financial system. Now, what you're arguing for, and I absolutely support it, is to unscramble all that, get our banks to do the things that they should be doing, which is effectively providing funding for proper businesses and households to do the things that they need to do. In other words, banking should be boring, right?
It should be boring.
Yeah, banking should not be high risk. And because we don't know the amount of the exposures in the system, because the reporting is so limited, right, nobody knows just how leveraged our financial system is to both the local, but more importantly, the global markets. And that's the problem that we've got to tackle head on and tackle now, because, as Frydenberg said, in a crisis, these things could go wrong.
And needless to say, I think we were both surprised that after years of banging on about this, that this letter emerged from the Treasurer asking this question. It shows you that there's not total ignorance, and that was a sort of a relief to a degree. But okay, what are they going to do about it?
Yeah.
Because if you the assumptions that people have held to regarding derivatives from the beginning have all ended in disaster. So you've got to understand how dangerous they are. So that's the tone of the letter. So now the ball's in Jim Chalmers' court. What's he going to do?
Yeah, absolutely. And the final point I wanted to make is the other thing people need to understand is that this overlay of derivatives actually impact the underlying markets too. So if you look at the price of gold, for example, or other commodities, right, a lot of those are actually being driven not by the underlying, just supply and demand, but they're being driven by all these bets that sit over the top. So it actually has introduced a whole additional instability layer in the financial system. And while people often argue, well, it creates more liquidity and that's good because that helps price discovery, actually it doesn't. It goes precisely in the other direction. It actually makes price discovery impossible. It actually basically makes the price driven by the derivatives and all those bets being taken rather than by the underlying, which then creates another layer of instability in the system. Again, this is something that needs to be tackled, and it needs to be tackled locally and globally, because this is probably one of the biggest undiffused bombs we've got in the financial system. If you overlay that with the debt bomb, we've got these two bombs just ticking away, right? And the risk is they could go off, and if they go off, it's ordinary businesses and ordinary households that end up being hit.
Well, there's a famous City of London trader, Peter Hambrough, who has just come out and blown the whistle on how the gold market is a derivatives mess. Yep. It's not real. It's all derivatives. And I'll point this out about Peter Hambrough, Martin. I've been campaigning for Glass-Steagall, going back to separating the banks, since 2009. And in the mid 20 teens, a whole bunch of well-credentialed British politicians and ex-investment bankers came out and got behind the campaign. And he was one of them. Now, what I'm pointing out is that as a gentleman of a certain age and experience, Hambrough clearly has the place to stand to understand when the financial system went haywire because this, you know, cancer derivatives came in and everything stopped being real, right? So he has that perspective, and that's why he supported Glass-Steagall, and that's why he's been able to blow the whistle now on the derivatives in the gold market, because he sees things that a whole bunch of younger people, I would wager, have never known any different, don't see. Right. And, you know, because they love recruiting, you know, 20 something year olds, they don't even remember the global financial crisis, these kids. And they're the people that they love employing in this rapid fire world of derivative speculation. And they don't get it. And you've got to take notice of people like Peter Hambrough saying that. So he said that about the gold market. We're saying it to you, the viewer, about your own bank. Your bank in Australia is up to its neck in this mess. And we need to get the government to identify that, hang on, there's a very sick financial system here, riddled with this cancer of derivatives. We're going to have to excise it. And there's, like I said, we've got the solutions, but we need to first acknowledge the problem. Maybe this letter from Frydenberg is a crack of light. And maybe by the way they formulated the reply, the Council of Financial Regulators have actually given the game away, because if they had to go to so much effort to emphasize the restrictions on super derivatives to say they're safe, but they cannot tell you that your banks have the same restrictions, because they don't, by definition, they're admitting that they're not safe. And it's a much bigger problem than whatever the super funds may have.
Absolutely, Robbie. Well, I appreciate your time today, and very important subject. We'll come back to again, I'm sure, because this is, you know, one of those big, big issues that is almost too big for people to address. But it can be addressed. But step one is to understand the problem. And that letter, I think, really does, as you say, it shines a very important spotlight on a very important issue. Thanks for your time.
Thanks, Martin.
Okay, see you.